Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Although born in Palestine some 2,000 years ago, and having flourished in northern Africa and the Middle East for many centuries after its founding, Christianity today is often considered a European religion. This is not entirely surprising, given that Christianity's largest formal institution, the Roman Catholic Church, bases itself in Italy. Moreover, it was Germany and Switzerland that gave rise to Protestant Christianity. And Eastern Orthodoxy, while originating in Constantinople, finds its home mostly in European countries such as Greece, Russia, and Bulgaria. The once thriving Christian cities of Alexandria, Antioch, and Carthage now exist in nations with overwhelmingly Muslim populations. It was also from Europe, and by extension the United States, that Christian missionaries began spreading their religion with fervor in the 19th and 20th centuries to the continents of Asia, Africa, and even Latin America, where Protestants challenged the colonial Catholic legacy. But how accurate is it today to consider Christianity a European religion? How have changes in the demographics of the world affected the way in which Christianity is practiced? Is the perceived decline of Christianity in Europe likely to result in a waning of the faith throughout the world? Or are we currently witnessing a revival in Christianity in the non-European global south? Is Islam successfully displacing Christianity in Africa and Asia? Or is Christianity spreading more rapidly in those regions? If Christianity is alive and well in other regions of the world, what does it look like? Is it similar to the religion practiced in Europe? Or does it have its own theological and liturgical flavor? And finally, can our understanding of Christian history over the past two millennia give us any insight into the state of Christianity today and some idea of what it may look like in the near future? To discuss these questions with us, I am very pleased to be joined by Philip Jenkins, one of the world's foremost historians of Christianity, the Edwin Earl Sparks Professor of Humanities at Penn State University, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion. Professor Jenkins holds numerous other appointments, and listing them all would leave me little time to acknowledge that he is author of roughly two dozen books, including The Next Christendom, The Rise of Global Christianity, The New Faces of Christianity, Believing the Bible in the Global South, and most recently, The Jesus Wars, How Four Patriarchs, Three Queens, and Two Emperors Decided What Christians Would Believe for the Next 1,500 Years. Philip, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you.
Just a question on that last book that I mentioned, The Jesus Wars, How Four Patriarchs, Three Queens, and Two Emperors Decided What Christians Would Believe. Was there any room for a partridge in a pear tree there?
We were thinking of it, but it wasn't theologically enough.
Okay. Great titles, by the way, and I recommend to all our readers that they pick up at least one, if not several, of your books on religion, but you also have written a great deal on non-religious topics as well, including a history of the 60s and what it has resulted here in the United States. So we'll link a number of those of books on our podcast website, so please make sure you visit and pick up some of those books. Now, Philip, you're a historian, so I figured the best place for us to start our discussion would be with history here. And you have recently, in a guiding paper posted on the Association of Religious Data Archives at Penn State, and we'll link to that again too, you posted a paper that says understanding religious phenomena in the contemporary period can be significantly enhanced by a reading of the historical record. Why is history so important, and why haven't some scholars really picked up on that?
Well, my argument is that everybody uses history, whether they realize they're doing it or not, and the best thing they can do is get it right. And what I mean by that is, even if somebody doesn't think they are using history, they work from a particular model, which in fact is very historical. So, for example, when people think of the origin, the growth of Christianity, they have a historical map in mind, something that begins in the Middle East, spreads over Europe, spreads over America. And then my point is that is, in fact, only a very partial account of the story. At the same time, it's spreading west, it's spreading east into Asia, it's spreading south into Africa. You could regard that as a geographical curiosity, mm-hmm. but something else is happening at the same time. As Christianity is spreading in those other directions, it also has a different ethnic character than we think of. And also, it runs up against a lot of different cultures that we tend not to think of. You know, one of the great examples there is in the modern world, we think Christianity is having its first encounter with great world religions like Hinduism and Buddhism. In fact, the Christian encounter with Buddhism goes back to the 6th and 7th centuries. And in the Middle Ages, a lot of Christians in Asia are using a symbol, which is a combination of the cross and the Buddhist lotus. Mm. So Christianity has been in conversation with other religions for a long time. But my basic point is that a lot of what we believe to be, if you like, a standard and orthodox Christian history, in fact isn't. It's a very partial account. And that gets to maybe my most important question of all: what is the core of Christianity, as opposed to just the cultural accidents that we think of from being in Europe? Mm-hmm. What is the heart of the Christian religion? And that's a pretty fundamental question.
Let's go ahead and explore that. So what would be your take on that? I mean, again, if you ask anybody here in the United States, we think of Christianity as being a European religion. It's, you know, centered in Rome, or if you're Catholic, or different Protestant faiths and stuff. And what's historically wrong with that picture?
Well, let me give you a couple of examples there. A few years ago, Pope Benedict made a speech which was very controversial because he seemed to be suggesting that Islam was a very violent religion, and that attracted a lot of controversy. But in the same speech, he said something which was even more controversial. He said Christianity has to be rooted in Greek philosophy, in the Greek philosophical tradition, and that's where a lot of our words, our terms come from, mm-hmm. okay? However, there was a large and flourishing Christian tradition in the Middle Ages which tried to make Christianity speak to other philosophical traditions, to Confucianism, to Taoism, to Buddhism. Maybe they succeeded in some ways, maybe they failed in some ways, but that was an ancient historical effort. You know, the example that always comes to my mind, a few years ago I was in Australia, and I walked into the local Anglican cathedral, which is a beautiful building in Adelaide, and the city itself is very Pacific. It's very sunny. It's this very warm climate, and yet the cathedral looked like it was from Germany or England in the Middle Ages. The idea was people took what they thought to be quote Christian architecture, mm-hmm. unquote Christian culture, and took it around the world. Well, we look at that today and we think, no, what they're bringing is Europe. Uh-huh. What is it about the rest of Christianity that actually comes from Europe, comes from the Middle Ages, as opposed to being a universal? The standard Western account of the atonement in theology actually reflects a lot of not just European thought, but European feudal thought. How much of that can be transformed, can be changed, as Christianity once again becomes a global religion? That's not saying that there is not a historic core of the Christian faith, but it's important to distinguish that from the Europeanness.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting to figure that out. I mean, a lot of people don't think of his. St. Augustine actually wrote most of his tracts in northern Africa. Is that correct?
Augustine was an African. In fact, most Western Catholic Latin thought originates in the lands that we now call Tunisia and Algeria. A great deal of the earliest Christianity, including probably large chunks of the New Testament, comes from Egypt, and but by the time Christian missionaries reach Anglo-Saxon London, around about the year 600, there are Ethiopians who are in their 10th generation of Christianity. So Christianity in some ways has got much deeper roots on the African continent than in Europe. And, you know, Christianity, of course, originates in Syria and Palestine, which are geographically part of Asia.
So what happens that gives Christianity its European flavor? Is there some kind of tipping point? Is it the Muslim expansion that makes us forget about the Middle East roots and pushes everything to Europe, and or what?
It's an interesting question as to why things get forgotten in history. You know, people spend a lot of time figuring out how we remember, but how we forget is in some ways equally important. The Muslims conquer the Middle East and North Africa in the mainly in the 7th century. But for several hundred years afterwards, what we think of as the Muslim countries are in fact Muslim elites ruling over largely Christian populations, and the process of conversion is very slow. Probably by the time you get to the year 1000, like 300 or 400 years after the Muslim invasions, by the year 1000 there are probably more Christians in Asia than in Europe. So there's a gradual process of Muslim growth, but what finally pushes them, pushes Christians over the edge is what happens in the 13th century, when there's an age of political catastrophes associated with sudden climate change. There's a great age of global cooling, which leads to economic contraction, famine, leaves people open to plague. And at that point, a very damaged society starts looking for scapegoats. And in Europe, they find them in the Jews. And that is the point at which most West European Jewish communities are destroyed, and Jews are forced into Eastern Europe. And in the Middle East, and actually in China, the authorities turn against Christians. And that is the point at when you get massacres, expulsions, and forced conversions. So probably by about 1300 to 1350, that's when these ancient Christian communities are pretty much destroyed.
So you'd have to say that Christians then have much more to fear from global cooling than global warming, I would guess.
Well, global sudden climate change, in whatever direction it goes. But if you think of that chronology, if you think of the whole history of Christianity as 2,000 years, that means that Christianity is still very strong in the Middle East, in North Africa, in much of Asia, until two-thirds of the way through the story of the faith. And it's only after 1400, 1500 that we have the picture that we think of today, where Christianity is very much a European religion for Europeans. And that's the point at which that version begins to be spread around the rest of the world.
And that is fascinating to know that Christianity is, you know, was spreading as far as China in the first millennium, just, you know, to the point where they eventually were persecuted for it, which is somewhat surprising. We only think of Christianity invading China or becoming a presence in China in the last, several decades. And So let's bring this up to the past, or excuse me, bring the past up to the present here a little bit. And what does this understanding of history, of Christian history, of how it spread and what it looked like a millennium or more ago, tell us about Christianity today?
Well, as I've argued, we're living through a very revolutionary time in the history of Christianity, and with a very radical change in the space of a century or so, which, you know, against the whole span of history is not large. Back in 1900, Christianity was overwhelmingly a Euro-American religion. Something like 83% of all Christians lived either in Europe or North America. Probably by the time you get to 2050, that proportion will be close to reversed. In other words, that it'll be 70 or 80% of Christians who live in Africa, Asia, Latin America. The really amazing story is what happens in Africa. Back in 1900, African Christians made up round about 1.6% of the world's Christian population. By 2050, there'll be over a third of the world's Christian population. Back in 1900, there were 10 million Christians in Africa. By 2050, there'll be over a billion, and that's a pretty secure kind of projection. Mm-hmm. So Christianity is going south quite rapidly. And that change is in progress as we speak. I mean, the numbers are shifting away very fast from Europe especially, but to Africa, Asia, Latin America, and that works just across the board, whichever denomination, whichever church you're looking at. So somebody made a point to me the other day about a very small denomination, which was the Moravians, you know, not a huge mm-hmm. Group. But that already today there are more Moravians in Tanzania than there are in the rest of the world. And that's true, or something like that is true for many different denominations, that the numbers have shifted so much to particularly Africa and Asia.
And this is somewhat surprising, because again, if you watch the news media today, you would get the impression that it's not Christianity that's growing rather rapidly, but it's Islam, and that Islam is spreading into Africa. We think of Northern Africa as definitely being Islamic, but then, you know, toss in some countries in sub-Saharan Africa, Nigeria, being an example. And one would say, well, come on, you know, Christianity's on the losing end of this here. It's Islam that is really expanding faster. Is that the case?
You know, if you ever look at Wikipedia, there's a quite a funny entry called the world's fastest growing religion. And the entry is there almost as a joke, because when you look at it, you see about 20 different candidates for what that fastest growing religion is. And the point is, everybody claims mm-hmm. it. Islam is one of the candidates, and it certainly is true that Islam has expanded very rapidly over the last century. Back in 1900, Muslims made up maybe 12% of the world's people. By the time you get to today, they're around 22%. So, you know, that's a big mm-hmm. increase. But I can also make the argument that the world's fastest growing religion is Christianity outside Europe. If you look at the whole the whole world, then the proportion of the world's people who are Christian remains pretty steady over time. In 1900, it's about a third. In 2000, it's about a third. In 2050, it'll probably be about a third. That's constant. But if you take Europe out of the picture, then, in fact, Christianity is expanding far more rapidly than Islam. I mentioned the African figures right now. The main reason for that, incidentally, is demographic, that there are far more Africans, for example, than there were in 1900. There are far more Asians, whereas Europeans remain pretty constant. Just give you an example of that. Back in 1900, Europeans outnumbered Africans by about 3-1. By 2050, Africans will outnumber Europeans by about 3-1. So, you know, you're just seeing this huge demographic shift. A rising tide lifts all boats religiously. Mm-hmm. And that means that there are far more African Christians, Asian Christians. So I would say that if you look at the world in 2050, probably around a third of the world's people will still be Christian, maybe a quarter will still be Muslim, but Christians will still be a good way ahead of Muslims in the if you think of it as a race in the you know, the world religion state.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned this as a demographic process. What about conversion? Is Christianity converting faster? Is this just a matter of having lots of kids?
It's both. The two processes go very closely together. And again, I can give you numbers for this if you look at Africa. I said, for one thing, there are far more Africans. Back in 1900, Christianity accounts for maybe 10% of the people of Africa. Today, it's about 46%. So the most important thing that happened in Africa in the 20th century probably was something like half the continent's people shifted their religion from animist, primal, what you can call pagan mm-hmm. faiths, to either Christianity or Islam. And by a ratio of about 4-1, they chose Christianity over Islam. So conversions are also a large part of the story.
Let me ask you as well about the differences between the continents. You talked a great deal about Africa, but what mm-hmm. what about its spread in Asia? Is that occurring at roughly the same pace? Is it faster in Africa, slower in Asia? What do we know about that?
It's by far the fastest in Africa, because if you think about it, it's starting pretty much from year zero. I mean, it's starting from close to zero.
Right.
In Asia, there are some old established Christian communities, but it's a much more patchy kind of growth. There are some centers, but there are huge areas of Asia where Christianity is made next to no impact. By far the most successful Christian story in Asia is the Philippines. Mm-hmm. Probably by 2050, that'll be one of the world's three or four largest Christian countries. And that'll also be a huge factor in the Roman Catholic Church. One figure I sometimes give is, if you want to think of a typical Catholic today, well, you know, here's a figure. In a typical year, there are more Catholic baptisms in the Philippines than in France, Spain, Italy, and Poland combined. So, you know, that's a big story. Korea, South Korea, again, is a huge story. Christians over the century went from about 1% maybe to 30%, and they have pretty much a cultural hegemony there. You know, Korea is one of the great Christian countries, one of the great missionary countries. Across most of Asia, certainly most of East Asia, Christians make up maybe 8 or 10% of the population. But, of course, it's a very big population.
Right.
So if you're dealing with, say, 5%, which is a reasonable estimate, of the population of China, that's still 60 or 70 million people, which is more Christians than you have in any European country.
Mm-hmm.
So Christians are nowhere near a majority in most Asian countries. Probably they will not be in my lifetime, but there are still large communities there.
Let me finish off the continents with a trip to Latin America, which is the continent that I've done most of my research on. And some
sure.
20 years ago, when I started my dissertation work, or when I began studying Latin America some 25 years ago, it's a Catholic nation. I mean, they're a Catholic continent. It's all, you know, everybody's been converted there and everything's fine. But, you know, as I found out, I was pretty surprised. There are some significant religious changes occurring there. What are those?
Well, as you know, very well, and you've written so much in your work. Back maybe in the mid-20th century, say in the 1950s, there were Protestant populations, and maybe they represented, you know, 1-2% of the populations in different countries. Those have expanded very rapidly. There are now a couple of countries, especially Chile and Guatemala, where maybe you're talking about 30 or 35% Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
Brazil, the most populous, probably the most important country in Latin America, reasonable estimate would maybe be 15%, some would say higher.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, there's a decline in Catholic numbers. Some people would say that Brazil these days, the Catholic population is maybe only something like 70% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
If you project that forward to 2050, no one would be too surprised if Brazil wasn't maybe 50-50
mm-hmm.
Protestant and Catholic. And at the same time, during the late 20th century, the Latin American population grew very rapidly, so that meant that even these small minorities represent quite substantial communities. And those Protestant, those Pentecostal populations have also had a real political impact,
mm-hmm.
and there have been some quite noteworthy Protestant leaders, or leaders supported by Protestant constituencies. So that's really been a very significant religious change in what, as you say, 20, 30 years ago was regarded as being the heartland of Catholicism.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, when you talk about the drop in Catholic numbers. In part, I think that is the case that Latin America was considered roughly 100% Catholic, you know, a century ago or 50 years ago, and any gains that Protestants made were going to come at the expense of that Catholicism. But I think, you know, what I've found is that Catholicism wasn't rooted that deeply, that there were a lot of people who were not touched by the Catholic Church. And when Protestant missionaries came in at the turn of the century, the last century, the 19th to 20th century, they quickly found that the population wasn't as Christianized as everybody thought, and they made fairly rapid gains in that regard.
Sure. Well, you know, that gets back to that question about what is the core mm-hmm. of Christianity as opposed to culture. And everyone would have said that a lot of what was happening in large parts of Latin America had a heavy dose of, you know, traditional native cultures. And the issue then was how much of that was Christian. Mm-hmm. But certainly, particularly among native and indigenous populations, a lot of people were absolutely ripe for conversion, mm-hmm. and that's been a large part of the story. But you know, it's interesting, by the way, because of the sheer numbers of the population, Latin America will continue to be probably the heartland of the Catholic mm-hmm. Church, even with those reduced numbers. And we're moving to an age very rapidly where Latin America is going to be by far the largest Catholic continent, the largest Catholic population. And but when you also include people of Latino origin in North America, mm-hmm. That becomes even more true. You know, the Catholic Church becomes ever more, if you like, Latinized.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier when we were talking about Latin America here, the expansion of Pentecostalism, and that really seems to be the trend in Latin America as well as Africa and other parts of the world. And I want to talk a little bit about not only the expansion in numbers here, but the qualitative changes. What is different about Christianity in the global South? And one of the things that struck me as we were just talking here, we mentioned that, you know, Chile is roughly about a third Protestant, and a bulk of that is Pentecostal. And we oftentimes mm-hmm. think of Chile as being the most European nation in South America, Argentina and Uruguay as well. But you know, it has a very Pentecostal feel, whereas many people assume Pentecostalism more with indigenous populations, say, in Guatemala. Pentecostalism seems to have a wide appeal throughout the world. And I'm wondering why this might be, and what does Pentecostalism look like throughout the world?
Right. You know, one problem that a lot of scholars run into is defining Pentecostalism.
Yes,
because
yeah.
You know, the traditional definition was one that looked at basically speaking in tongues and revivalism and so on. The more surveys that people do around the world, there are a huge number of churches that do not have those classical signs of Pentecostalism. And I suppose a number of people would just say, well, you know it when you mm-hmm. see it. And what you're looking at is, in terms of historic origins coming out of these kind of revivals, very different from, if you like, mainline Protestantism. But certainly, I would say an emphasis on healing is one of the signs that you get in these churches. I actually tend to use the term charismatic and Pentecostal, mm-hmm. and that's not just being pernickety, but that distinguishes between strictly Pentecostal denominations, like the Assemblies of God or the Foursquare Gospel, right. And the kind of charismatic themes that you get in mainstream churches, you know, across Africa. You can go to like a Catholic church, a Lutheran church, an Anglican church, and a lot of what they do is very charismatic, and it looks very much like the local Pentecostal church. Mm-hmm. So I think partly it's a worship style. It's an interest in signs and wonders, an interest in healing. Mm-hmm. But the main doctrinal idea would be emphasis on the Holy Spirit and the works of the Holy Spirit above all. And linked to that would be a whole culture of revivalism. But it would be quite possible to come up with a strict definition of Pentecostalism, which would maybe exclude a lot of these churches. I tend to have a very broad definition myself.
It's interesting to, and I think you're absolutely right here, trying to put our finger on, you know, this is the style of Christianity that is occurring in the global South. It's just, you know, it's not possible. There's so much variety in there. But you emphasize some common themes here, namely healing. And
right.
The power of the Holy Spirit. Why do you think that is the case? I heard you give a talk on this a few months back, and this was one of the most fascinating aspects of the talk is, you know, why does healing have such a special appeal in Latin America, in Asia, and in Africa?
You know, it's interesting. One thing I always try and emphasize is that, you know, there is no such thing as, if you like, global South religion, mm-hmm. because you have so many differences. But also, you know, I'm speaking at the moment from Texas. I wouldn't have to go far in the city where I am right now and find churches which are deeply committed to healing, and they wouldn't necessarily be Latin American churches. I would suggest that the idea of healing is actually very common in Christianity, and maybe in the United States, in Europe, it's been pushed into the background more, and it's not seen as quite a central or respectable part of Christianity, mm. but it is there. You know, one point I always make is if you look at Europe, one of the most important things that's happened in the last 25 years is an enormous historic upsurge in the revival of pilgrimage. In other words, people go to pilgrimage shrines, and the reason they go there is often to seek healing. So I think this is a very widespread impulse in all world religions. It's certainly not just a Pentecostal thing. It's not just something that you get in, say, Latin America or mm-hmm. Africa. It might be that where you have societies where access to any kind of Western medicine is scarce or non-existent, then concerns about healing of the body become very important. Much of the healing that people seek in Latin American churches is a broader kind of healing from substance abuse, from personality mm-hmm. Disorders, that you can't separate healing of the mind and the body and the family and society. So I think maybe healing is a useful lens to look across these churches, and then you combine that with the ecstatic, passionate form of worship, and it's a very appealing image. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if legal, political boundaries to that kind of Christianity were removed, whether it would spread much wider, much faster, even than it has already.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about it being in Texas, and you
right.
talked this about as a common theme in Christianity, and we just tend to push it to the background here. Is it the case that this is common among Americans of several generations, or is this an immigrant phenomenon?
No, obviously there are old established Pentecostal denominations in the United States. I mean, there are holiness denominations, mm-hmm. and both those go back to the late 19th, early 20th century. You know, the great examples I always cite is African American churches. You know, whenever people look at global Christianity, whenever Americans look at global Christianity, I think some forget that they've had something very much like that on their soil for a very long time. You know, African American churches have long been deeply interested in healing, signs of the spirit, interestingly, ways of reading the Bible, which today are commonly found in global South churches. So maybe you can see the African American churches as a, if you like, a first draft of global South Christianity.
Tell me a little bit more about their reading of the Bible. I mean, when you think of reading of the Bible, one could think of somebody in a theological school sitting down and studying it in a very intellectual fashion. But how is it when you say reading the Bible in the global South or in African American churches or in churches that have been experienced by the holiness movement? What are we talking about here?
Well, suppose, for the sake of argument, you are you're reading the Gospels. I mean, you have the same body of texts groups, you have the same words, but you can read them with different emphases. For example, somebody today from a very kind of liberal or progressive church might read the Gospels and, you know, get through all these charming but basically silly miracle stories to get to Jesus's wise mm-hmm. words. And Jesus is a moral teacher, and the miracles become almost an embarrassment. If you're reading the Bible in a group in, South Africa, then it's above all the healings and the miracle stories, which give the Gospels their power. You know, rather like the people in the first and second centuries, the great figures of the Old Testament, figures like Elijah and Elisha. Mm-hmm. And you have these really powerful miracle stories that speak to people of a later generation because they deal with those concerns. You know, Elijah and Elisha dealt with things like bringing rain to cure a drought. Mm-hmm. That kind of miraculous power, the control over the real world, and above all, the power to defeat and suppress evil and evil spirits. That's a very attractive package.
Mm-hmm. And we, again, as you mentioned, more intellectualized traditions of Christianity here in the United States or in Europe have tend to sanitize many of those things out. As you say, oh, it's a different culture, different time. They needed those stories to draw people into the Bible 2,000 years ago or so. Does this help explain some of the rift that might be growing between churches that were founded or principally located in European countries and their Global South offshoots? I'm thinking about the split within the Anglican Communion. Sure. To what extent is there this growing rift, and what could we say about this in the future? How's this going to change?
Well, you know, if you think about it, a large part of that rift is described in theological terms, and it's over issues of morality mm-hmm. and sexuality. But absolutely at the center of the issue is the whole question of authority. What should we believe and why should we believe it? And here, ways of reading the Bible come to be fairly central. If you read the Bible and you have this very historic view that this is something that was written for an ancient world and it's got nothing to do with us today, then it makes it hard to treat the moral instructions there very seriously. If you read the Bible and you read in it a description of your world and you see things that are happening all around you, then you naturally tend to accept the moral messages that go along with that. You know, the example I use is the book of Leviticus. The book of Leviticus has got very harsh words to say on homosexuality, but it also has many other things that were designed for basically a tribal society 3,000 years ago. That have got no relevance today. If you're reading a large part Leviticus in a large part of modern Africa, those other things also speak to a modern world, and that makes people more willing to believe the harsh words about homosexuality. Mm. Many African readers of the Bible, for instance, are overwhelmed to find just how African it sounds. Mm. It describes a world where people practice nomadism. They know about blood sacrifice. There are these pagan religions. There are these polygamous tribes. It sounds very much like, if not the exact modern world, then just the world of Africa a generation or so ago. So it's our book written for our times.
Mm-hmm. That is rather fascinating. I have to recount one of my own stories. When Pope John Paul II died, I received a number of calls from the media, and one of the questions that routinely cropped up was, well, you know, the Christianity or Catholicism has been moving south, and so we're going to get a Latin American bishop or an African bishop was the running bet at the time. And the question always came up, well, this is going to be a much more, you know, theologically liberal or theologically progressive type of bishop. And I had to stop and say, no, I don't really think that's the case, because you will you tend to find a, you know, what we would term here in the United States a much more conservative theology found in the global South. I mean, is that your read of the situation?
Yeah. One thing you you learn is how ideas tend to go in packages. Mm. So we use a term like liberal. So, for instance, if someone in America says they are liberal, then you immediately know what they think about, you know, gun control and abortion and a dozen other issues. In other words, all the ideas are linked. When you look at other parts of the world, you realize that's not the case, that somebody can be very liberal on one sort of issue and very conservative on another sort of issue. There are many African churches, for instance, which are conservative or even fundamentalist by Northern world terms, but are economically, socially very liberal indeed. John Allen, who's a very shrewd observer of the Roman Catholic Church, recently wrote a book called The Future Church, which imagines the Roman Catholic Church in 2050, which is under a an African pope called Pope Victor. Mm-hmm. And Pope Victor is ferocious and prophetic on ideas of wealth distribution and international debt and social justice. But he also takes very seriously ideas of deliverance, spiritual warfare, and takes ideas like witchcraft very seriously. Mm-hmm. You know, conservatism and progressive views mix in a way that are puzzling in the North.
Well, let me play on that theme there, as you say that, you know, the mix of different political ideologies or of different social ideologies and social views on things is rather mixed in the developing world. One thing that has fascinated me has been the progress of liberation theology within the Catholic Church and perhaps how it's played out in a number of Protestant churches. Now, if you trace liberation theology per se, its history back over the past 50 or 60 years, it's really a European, it has its European intellectual roots, and then tries spreading into Latin America in the 1960s and 1970s. But I haven't seen that movement of liberation theology picking up on a lot of the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount specifically, blessed are the poor and stuff. I haven't seen that getting as much traction as, say, what we were talking about earlier, the holiness or the healing. Is that what you're seeing? And if so, you know, what might explain that?
Right. You know, that gets into a complex set of issues. There's a lot of it, of course, is a war, if you like, a culture war within the Roman Catholic Church. And from the late 1970s, you know, Pope John Paul tries very hard to appoint bishops who are going to fight hard against liberation theology. And it would be easy to write the obituary of that. But then, of course, in the last few years, we've seen liberation theologians come back. One old-time liberation theologian from the 1970s is now the president of Paraguay. Mm. And you find old-time liberation people quite active supporting the governments of Bolivia and Venezuela. So, you know, maybe it's not as dead as we thought a few years ago.
Let me challenge you a little bit on that, because at the intellectual level, liberation theology has always had, it has a great deal of traction. A number of scholars here in the United States have keyed in on it as intellectually important. But at the level of the populace, so the regular folks who are out there practicing religion, you know, in their daily lives, liberation theology doesn't seem to have as much say in their lives as, say, some of these other, you know, movements, the healing movement, and, you know, Pentecostalism doesn't seem to have, which has attracted a large number of people, or charismatic Protestantism which has attracted a lot of people in Latin America. You don't see that liberation theology theme within them. And so if I looked at this in a market situation, people are opting for more of the spiritual side of religion than the more politically motivated side of liberation theology.
You know, I think it may be a matter of emphasis between us, because if I look at, say, a lot of Pentecostal churches, you know, certainly they don't use classical liberation theology, and they certainly don't accept a lot of the Marxist framework that it came with. On the other hand, they are not politically quietist. Mm-hmm. They're often very active in, you know, in local issues. You know, in Chile, for instance, you'll find that it's the local church that goes out and tries to get the road repaired or get sanitation done. And the scripture, and they will also root this political activism in readings of the Bible. Like I say, not in a Marxist classical liberation theology way, but they are prepared to be politically active. Even more so, by the way, in Africa, where human rights rhetoric and the rhetoric that they deploy against dictatorial governments will often deploy the same kind of texts that were very familiar to Latin American liberation theologians in the 70s. So maybe these ideas haven't lost their appeal quite as totally as we might sometimes think.
I'm wondering if it is a matter of emphasis here, too, because the liberation theology that I grew up reading and studying was really about, as you say, the Marxist influence dependency theory, a great deal of systemic change. We changed the system. Whereas the politics of charismatic Pentecostalism tends to be more change yourself first and then the system will change. And, you know, and so when you talk about the local Pentecostal church in Chile working to change road repairs, or in Brazil, there's been a number of Pentecostal leaders who have gotten into politics and have been elected at the local level, in large part because people trust them, you know, relative to the corrupt governments they've had over the several decades. Here's a Pentecostal minister. We know we can trust him with the purse strings of the you know, town budget in that regard. So I think that might be where I'm getting at in terms of this.
I just want to pick up on something you said, because I think it's one of the things which people pay not nearly enough attention to when you look at the success of churches in the Global South, and that is corruption. Mm-hmm. The idea that the whole secular world is thoroughly corrupt, and the churches offer a chance of providing an alternative. Now, you know, obviously there are tons of scandals in different churches. Nobody doubts that for a second. But in Africa, for instance, if you look at a country like Nigeria, which for 40 years has basically been under what you can only call a series of organized crime syndicates, if you're an intelligent, decent, honest person in that world, the last thing you want to do is have anything to do with government or that kind of public realm. Mm-hmm. And if you want to commit yourself to working for the betterment of society, you go into churches. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true around the world, and I think that's something that scholars of Global South religion really understate, but it's very, very important.
It is an absolutely fascinating topic. Timur Kuran, who we recently had here on Research on Religion, has written a book, Islam and Mammon, talking about the Islamic economics movement, or Islamism. Mm-hmm. He makes essentially the same case. He says why you see a lot of radical Islamic sects or this turning to Islamic economics has been because they exist in societies that are abysmally corrupt, and churches or religious organizations basically offer an alternative system for people who, as you say, are honest, decent, hardworking people to get buy-in.
Right. Yeah, and in fact, I think the way would be wide open for somebody to write a book like that about Christianity.
Mm-hmm. I think that'd be a very good topic. Well, with we have about 5 to 10 minutes left here. I want to talk about reverse evangelization, if that is that's something on the horizon here, because we talked about the spreading of Christianity, in the Global South, and how it has spread. And implicitly at the beginning of our conversation, we talked about the waning of Christianity in Europe. We see what might be perceived as a secularization in Europe. But at the same time, we notice that there's been a lot of south to north immigration, not only into Europe, but also into the United States and such. And is there going to be a reverse evangelization effect? Is the way that religion or Christianity is practiced in the global south going to have any impact on the north of Europe or the United States? And go out on a limb and say, might we expect a religious revival in Europe because of what has been happening in the global south?
Right. Well, so much of this stuff has been going on for really 30 or 40 years. And I draw a distinction. There are a couple of different things happening. One is that migrant populations come to a country like the United States or Germany or France, and they do the kind of religion that seems natural to them. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that spreads out into the mainstream society. Separately from that, you also get a deliberate evangelization where somebody will leave, you know, Nigeria, say, with an intention of going off to convert the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. or whatever. And those are two different phenomena, but they tend to contribute towards the same goal. We're already seeing a huge amount of this. Think about it. The largest religious institution in the United States is the Roman Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. By some projections, by 2050, something like 85% of Catholics in the United States will be Latino. And at the moment, you know, it's a large proportion. Presently, if you look at Catholics in the United States, the proportion of Latinos who claim to be charismatic or Pentecostal Catholics is something like 55%.
Right.
Among non-Latino Catholics, it's 12%.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to a Latino Catholic parish, you're much more likely to see something that looks like a charismatic Pentecostal church. That's already happening now. That's not evangelization. It's just people moving and taking their religious styles with mm-hmm. them. And you get a great deal of that in Europe. In London, for instance, on a typical Sunday, half the worshippers at Christian churches will be black. They will either be African or Afro-Caribbean. This change has happened and will continue to happen. The other way you see it is actually, again, within the Roman Catholic Church, a very disproportionate number of the priests in the Catholic Church are Global South.
Mm-hmm.
They're Vietnamese, they're Mexican, they're Nigerian. One thing I like is you now even get Nigerian Catholic priests turning up in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
It's not evangelization, but it is a change of worship styles and of beliefs about authority.
I'm wondering if we need to really, as scholars, rethink what we consider to be evangelization, because when I use the term evangelization, I'm sure it invokes an image in somebody's mind of somebody standing on a box in a town square with a Bible telling people to convert mm-hmm. or they shall go to hell. But it might be much more subtle than that, and I think you're putting your finger on that you know, different worship styles come up, that a Nigerian priest is now in Ireland, or a Brazilian priest is somewhere in Texas, and people look at that and they say, "Oh, I haven't seen that before," and that's really interesting. I don't think I was as interested in the Catholic Church down the street, kind of a more Latin Mass type of thing, and now there's this charismatic thing, and that really interests me. I think I'm going to walk in the door there and give that a try. That might be how evangelization occurs in this regard.
Well, you know, just to get back to something we were talking about a moment ago. In England, the Church of England, the Anglican Church, is in deep trouble, but there are a few parishes which have basically become mega churches. And there's one interesting mm-hmm. one, which is in a place called Chorley Wood, and it's an absolutely flourishing mega church. It's very charismatic. It believes in miracles. It believes in healing. It believes in signs.
And it's within the Anglican framework.
Within the Anglican framework, but the reason it did that was its rector, its priest, was a guy who'd lived a lot of time in Chile mm-hmm. and seen Chilean Pentecostalism, and then he brought that back to England. And so you have a lot of people who are, you know, white British people who are suddenly exposed to this tradition, and they take it up as their mm-hmm. own. The other great example of that is the work of Sunday Adelaja in the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Who's a Nigerian pastor of a church with, what is it now, 40 or 50,000 members. Virtually all the members are white. Mm. They're Ukrainian or they're Russian. but their worship style is very African.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that, you know, one would never expect, right? A Nigerian pastor in the Ukraine would be the last place in the world, but, you know, leading an incredibly successful movement to show, you know, really that Christianity is a dynamic and constantly changing form of religion that has spread, you know, as we talked about early on here, that, you know, it spread early in its initial decades and initial centuries, and it's changing and spreading in ways that we might not expect here in the present contemporary
right.
period.
And, you know, it's just a case of the story continues as always. I mean, that's what it's always mm-hmm. done, and the sense of it being something which is always European is just, you know, just wrong, just not historical.
Well, this has been a wonderful discussion in trying to, you know, wrapping this all up. We've come to a really nice full circle here where we understand that, you know, what we've seen in the history of the world or history of Christianity is really still playing itself out today, and that we can learn a great deal from the past to understand our present situation, and including, you know, checking out a number of your books that you've had and written a number of interesting things on this. There's one thing I also have to close with here is that many people might not know this, but Philip Jenkins also happens to be an aficionado of Westerns, of mm-hmm. Western movies. So I have to ask you, for the public record, what do you consider your top three favorite Western movies?
Boy, will I be choosing from such a large range. John Wayne's The Searchers would have to be high mm-hmm. on the list. Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch, and probably Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, but I could come up with a great many candidates.
Well, I'm sure that your knowledge of Western history is as extensive as it is of Christian history, and would love to talk about that someday, but we are running out of time here, and we want to thank Philip Jenkins for joining us today on Research on Religion. Philip, thank you very much for being on the show.
Hey, thank you. Good talking to you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.